You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 13th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Can't Touch This, Hands-On Defibrillation. Our guest skeptic today is Dr. Manrique Yumana. Manrique is an emergency physician from San Jose, Costa Rica, and is the residency program director. He is also the co-author of a Spanish-based blog called viamedem.com and an active person in the FOMED world. Welcome to the SGEM, Manrique.
Hey, hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Now, we are doing this recording in beautiful Costa Rica.
That's right, Ken. You're here teaching the Emergency Medical Abstract course.
And what an awesome location for some high-quality continuing medical education.
But you're not always in the classroom, Ken. I took you and your wife, Barb, on a full-day tour of Costa Rica. This included visiting a coffee plantation, hiking around waterfalls, seeing exotic animals, and eating some authentic Costa Rican food.
Costa Rican food. Yeah, and I've also got some great training runs in for the SMAC Chicago meeting, and I went zip lining through the jungle yesterday.
But there are many more things to do here in Costa Rica, Ken. You will have to come back, probably.
Oh, but I don't want to leave. But before we get on to the case scenario for today's SGEM podcast, can you tell me about the saying down here, pura vida?
That's right, Ken. It's pura vida. It literally means pure life. It's a saying here, kind of peaceful, simple, uncluttered life with deep appreciation of nature.
Well, I'm certainly getting a deep appreciation for Costa Rica, thanks to you being a wonderful host. But let's give a case scenario for today's SGEM podcast, because we are making all the listeners, especially in the northern climate, very jealous about the wonderful weather we're having here. So what's your case for today's podcast?
You received in your ED a 55-year-old male who goes into cardiac arrest minutes after he arrives in the triage area. He's rushed into the shock room and CPR is started.
So chest compressions are ongoing, and as soon as the monitor pads are attached, you notice that the patient's in V-fib. A resident next to you says that he's read that a patient can be shocked without stopping chest compressions.
Everyone in the room immediately turns their eyes on you to make the call, and the intern doing CPR asks if it's really safe to do so.
So the question we're going to ask on today's podcast is it safe to shock a patient during ongoing chest compressions, so-called hands-on defibrillation? But let's give the audience some background.
Okay, defibrillation is the treatment of choice for rhythm disturbances like ventricular fibrillation and ventricular tachycardia without a pulse. Rapid and early defibrillation has been shown to increase survival after cardiac arrest.
Yeah, and there are some suggestions that a short period of CPR should be done prior to defibrillation for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. However, a systematic review by Simpson et al. In Resuscitation 2010 on this topic demonstrated no superiority of delayed versus immediate shocking.
High-quality chest compressions have also been shown to improve outcomes in cardiac arrest to the extent that delays in starting them and even brief interruptions are associated with worse survival rates.
Yeah, the American Heart Association, or the AHA guidelines, stress no interruption. And CHESK, that's CHESKES, et al., did a study called Peri-Shock Pauses, an Independent Predictor of Survival from Out-of-Hospital Shockable Cardiac Arrest. And this was published in Circulation 2011. And it was a chart review of just over 800 resuscitations for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. They did multivariable logistic regressions to determine the association between survival and peri-shock pauses. And guess what they found? That the longer the pauses, the worse your chance of survival to hospital discharge. And in fact, they could quantify it down to 5-second segments. So for every 5 seconds in pre-shock pauses, survival went down 18%. For every 5 seconds in peri-shock pauses, survival went down 14%. So they concluded that you should not delay shocking patients with a shockable rhythm.
Having this in mind, the use of hands-on defibrillation to reduce interruptions of chest compressions after cardiac arrest has been suggested as a means of improving resuscitation outcomes.
There's actually a study by Lloyd et al. In 2008 looking at the electrical current flow through rescuers who had their hands on the patients while they were being defibrillated. And they had 43 hands-on shocks, with most of them receiving 200 joules, but some of them actually got 360 joules.
None of the rescuers felt the shocks who wore polyethylene gloves.
And about 10% of the shocks were above the allowable 0.5 milliamps.
The authors concluded shocking while doing CPR was feasible.
I'm not sure an NNS number needed to shock of 10 exceeding the recommendation for exposure to providers is ready for prime time.
The potential dangers of this strategy in regard to exposing rescuers to electrical energy are still being debated.
Yeah, and the debate does indeed continue. There's even been studies on how much protection different gloves of different types might provide.
Sullivan and Chapman in 2012 study called Will Medicare Examination Gloves Protect Rescuers from Defibrillation Voltages During Hands-on Defibrillation?
Yeah, they looked at four different types of gloves. They looked at latex gloves, chloroprolene, nitrile, and vinyl.
They also tested single glove and double glove, both.
Yeah, there was two parts to the study. So in part one, they just took eight gloves and they just cranked up the voltage until the glove broke down. And then in part two of the study, they looked at two current levels, 0.1 milliamps and 10 milliamps.
45% of single gloves and 77% of double gloves allowed at least 0.1 milliamps of current flow with external defibrillation.
And 7.5% of single gloves and 6.2% of double gloves allowed at least 10 milliamps of current to flow with external defibrillation.
They concluded of the tested gloves, only a few limited the current to levels proven to be safe.
Now, there's been some good FOMED resources out there on the topic. Manrique, can you give a few?
Sure can. There's the Rebel EM, Salim's site has a good review. Also, Life is in the Fast Lane has one. And there's the MCrit podcast number 82 with Scott Weingart and Cliff Reed.
So the study we're going to talk about today seeks to determine the plausible worst-case energy transfer scenario that rescuers might encounter while performing routine resuscitative measures. So for this Costa Rican podcast, Manrique, what's the citation? What's the article you picked?
Okay, the paper is from Lemkin et al., Electrical Exposure Risk Associated with Hands-on Defibrillation. It's in Resuscitation 2014.
Now, I noticed that a summary of this article was available in Spanish. Is this why you picked the article?
Yeah, you got me.
Okay. So let's go through the PICO. What was the population they were dealing with?
They used eight cadavers from the Maryland State Board of Anatomy, neither frozen nor embalmed, with a body mass index between 12 and 29 kilograms per square meter.
And so what was the intervention that they were looking at?
First, they did resistance measurements taken from eight cadavers and two of the investigators using a calibrated multimeter connected to a monitoring electrodes placed 40 centimeters apart on the chest.
Yeah, and they used a variety of preparations to measure resistance differences: intact skin, abraded skin, water, saline, ultrasound gel, needle probes, and after which they measured resistance, ensuring that subsequent voltage measures during defibrillations were accurate.
After this scan, six of the cadavers were placed on tables, not grounded. Then adult defibrillator pads were placed on the anterior and posterior chest walls. Then they placed measurement electrodes, one in the back and the rest in diverse anatomic anterior landmarks. Voltages were measured with respect to the posterior electrode.
The anterior and posterior defibrillation pads were attached to the defibrillator, and 360 joules of biphasic discharges were given, with the subsequent voltages measured. So did they have a control group?
There was no control group.
And what was their outcome?
With the variables measured, resistance and voltage, they estimated the rescuer received dose to estimate energy received during defibrillation.
And so the author's conclusions were, quote, hands-on defibrillation using currently available personnel protective equipment and resuscitative procedures pose a risk to rescuers. The process should be considered potentially dangerous until equipment and techniques that will protect rescuers are developed. Now, normally, Manrique, what we do is we have a quality checklist that's been developed through the best evidence in emergency medicine to go through these studies, but we didn't have a quality checklist for a cadaver study. So we got the JBI, critical appraisal checklist for descriptive or case series. Is it okay if we use that and go through that with you?
Sure, that's right.
Okay, so question number one, was the study based on a random or pseudo-randomized sample?
No, that's...
Okay, so no to that one. Number two, were the criteria for inclusion in the sample clearly defined?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so they took those eight cadavers and they had a certain BMI. Number three, were confounding factors identified and strategies used to deal with them?
That's a no.
Were outcomes assessed using objective criteria?
Yes, Ken.
Yeah, so they were measuring voltage and stuff. Mm-hmm. Question number five, if comparisons are being made, was there sufficient descriptions of the group?
That's a non-applicable.
So it didn't apply?
That's
number
right.
Six, was the follow-up carried out over a sufficient time period?
Also non-applicable.
Okay, so that didn't apply. Number seven, let's see if we can find one that does apply. Were the outcomes of people who withdrew described and included in the analysis?
No, also not.
It'd be hard if you were a cadaver to remove yourself from the study, I believe.
Sure.
So question number eight, were the outcomes measured in a reliable way?
Yes, Ken.
And the last question, was appropriate statistical analysis used?
Yes, again.
All right, so why don't we go through the key results? What were the key results from this cadaver study?
Sure. Defibrillation resulted in rescuer exposure voltages ranging from 827 volts to around 200 volts, depending on cadaver and anatomic location. The rescuer received dose under that test scenarios ranged from 1 to 8 joules, which is in excess of accepted energy exposure levels.
So these results, this study certainly adds to the literature on the topic of hands-on defibrillation because it is something that's been discussed recently in the foam world. However, it's not really a patient-oriented or a provided-oriented outcome, is it?
No, it's not.
But what was the key message?
The key message is to perform high-quality chest compressions and defibrillate early.
So we often like to compare our conclusions to the author's conclusions, and we agree that the author's conclusions in that even though the amount of energy transferred during hands-on defibrillation might not be that much, it is sufficient to pose a threat to the medical personnel, and therefore, it should not be done at this time. But can you give us a bottom line?
Sure. Performing hands-on defibrillation poses a risk, and it's a practice that should be abandoned.
So let's go back to the case scenario. Go back to that resuscitation room. Can you give us a case resolution?
Well, you quickly state to the team that a recent study in resuscitation demonstrates that hands-on defibrillation is potentially dangerous and should not be done.
You keep up the compressions going while you charge the defibrillator to avoid longer pauses, but you do stop compressions and take your hands off for the electrical discharge and then immediately resume CPR. So how are you going to apply this clinically in your practice, Manrique?
Although you can find many case reports of people doing hands-on defibrillation, this study shows that there's risk involved and that this practice should be avoided. Instead, you can charge the defibrillator during the compressions and just stop for a brief period to give the discharge and then resume compressions immediately.
And so what are you going to tell your patients? But I guess because of this study, what are you going to tell the providers?
That the evidence available to this day shows that hands-on defibrillation is potentially dangerous and should not be done.
And that sound brings us to the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Dr. Glenn Armstrong from Beaver Lodge, Alberta. Glenn knew that that group of Ian Steele and company just published a new clinical decision tool on COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. The title of that paper was Clinical Characteristics Associated with Adverse Events in Patients with Exacerbations of Chronic Obstructive Pulmonary Disease, a Prospective Cohort Study, CMAJ 2014. Manrique, what question did you come up with for this week's Keener contest?
Keener question for this week is, who did and when the first defibrillation in humans?
Good question for the topic this week. Well, Manrique, thank you very much for doing the SGEM here in Costa Rica. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the FOMED world?
In fact, there is, Ken. We have some exciting news. Soon, I will be translating this SGEM blog and podcast to Spanish. This is to remove language as one of the knowledge translation barriers.
That's right, Manrique. We are taking the SGEM global. There are a few groups from around the world set up to translate the SGEM into French, Portuguese, Norwegian, and Polish. So stay tuned for a big announcement this spring. But until then, will you give the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.
Pura vida.